Good evening. It's delightful to be here in Melbourne and come and talk to you all and share some of the experiences I've had over these last few months, particularly May, which certainly turned out to be a very interesting month. Before starting, I would like to express my appreciation to the Institution of Engineers who have actually made this trip possible. They're the ones that sponsored my travel from the United States and around the country, and also to the Royal Aeronautical Society for sponsoring my visit here, and of course to RMIT. Thank you for allowing me to come and talk. What I'm going to do is talk about my shuttle flight, STS-77, and I'm going to do it by showing a few slides which capture some of the pre-launch activity and give you a sense of some of the payloads that we're carrying and what they're doing. And then I'm going to talk about how a vehicle is prepared for flight, then show a video which we put together from collections of video taken during the flight, which shows some of the formal activities that we were involved in, as well as some of the perhaps less formal activities of flying in space. And this is just the crew patch that we designed for our mission, which is designed to embody in a stylized form the various payloads we have, and many of you may have seen that already, and we wore this on our flight suits during the flight. This is where the fun really started. This is May the 19th, about 6:30 in the morning, Florida time, when we launched STS-77, and I had the privilege to ride on the flight deck up behind the window you see there on the right. And I was watching down into the flame trench at all those rather interesting things taking place below me. Before I go into the details, I would like to say something about this vehicle, because I think perhaps people don't really understand what an extraordinary vehicle it actually is for the variety of things that it can do. There's three elements that make up the shuttle system, and this is the shuttle with an orbiter on it. Oftentimes we just call the orbiter the shuttle, but actually the whole thing is called the shuttle, or the Space Transportation System, hence the name STS-77. The two solid rocket boosters, the brown external tank, and the orbiter itself. The solid rocket boosters put together in Utah and shipped in segments to the Cape, and they provide 70% of the thrust for the initial liftoff. They provide about 3.3 million pounds of thrust each, and the total vehicle weight is about 5.5 million pounds, fully loaded and fully fueled. So these solid rocket boosters are essential to our initial acceleration. That's first stage flight. They burn for about 2 minutes. They provide the 3.3 million pounds of thrust for 2 minutes each, and then they're jettisoned and they fall back to the ocean where they're recovered. While those are burning, in addition, we have the space shuttle main engines here. There's a cluster of three of them at the base of the orbiter itself. And these are liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines. And they are fed by fuel from the brown external tank. The external tank weighs about 1.7 million pounds and contains liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. It's actually the top one-third is cryogenic liquid oxygen, and the lower two-thirds are cryogenic liquid hydrogen. And that is fed into the engines and provides the thrust out of the engines. Each one of the shuttle main engines provides about 430,000 pounds of thrust, and that provides the second stage thrust. They are running during first stage when the solid rockets are running, but after the solid rocket goes, they're the only source of thrust, and they are what carry us actually up into orbit. The orbiter itself is a really amazing vehicle. This is a vehicle that is launched, as you see here, as a rocket, flies in space as a spacecraft, and then flies back into the atmosphere as an aircraft. But not just any aircraft. It's an aircraft that can fly hypersonically, supersonically, transonically, and subsonically. So it can cover a full range of speeds. It carries its own internal power. It's done by fuel cells, which generate electricity on board. It has five guidance computers, which are operating in synchronicity all the time, talking to each other to come up with voted instructions. What else? It carries hydraulic system on board. It has, in the aft end, three auxiliary power units. These are actually little turbines that are driven by hydrazine, and these are what power the hydraulic system. And hydraulics are important in this vehicle because during launch, these engines here, being at the base of the vehicle, are actually gimbaled. And they're what provide directional control as we climb up into the atmosphere. And so the hydraulics actually feeds the gimbals thrust vectoring pistons on the engines. Hydraulics are also used in entry. They provide deflection of all the elevons and ailerons and rudder and speed brake. They provide deployment, redundant deployment of the nose gear and the main gear just before touchdown, and they also provide braking. So the hydraulic systems are clearly very important to this vehicle. It also has other engines on board. These pods you see here are called orbital maneuvering engines. These provide about 6,000 pounds of thrust each, and they burn hydrazine, and they're what we use to make major changes in our orbit. If we want to change from one orbit to another orbit, we fire these engines, and that gives us the orbit change. It also has, in addition, a whole lot of smaller engines on it, which you can't see very well, but they're actually on these struts here on each side and also on the nose of the vehicle, and they point in all three directions. And these are called the reaction control system. And these little engines, which generate about 800 pounds each, are what we use to change the attitude of the orbiter while it's on orbit. In other words, we can pitch it up or roll it or yaw it so that we can get any desired attitude while we're on orbit with these engines. So I think you can see that the orbiter is a very sophisticated vehicle and really performs amazingly well. Well, this is the launch, and you may be inclined to think that this is the beginning of the flight. Well, it's the beginning of the flight, but it's not the beginning of the activities as far as we're, as members of the crew, are concerned. For us, we became involved with STS-77 in June of last year, of 95, when we were assigned to this flight. And I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the other members of this crew. It was a six-person crew. The commander was Colonel John Casper of the United States Air Force. The pilot was Colonel Kurt Brown, also of the Air Force. We also had Commanders Mario Runco and Dan Bursch of the United States Navy as mission specialists, and Dr. Mark Garneau of the Canadian Space Agency as a mission specialist. We immediately began pretty intensive training on all the payloads that we had. And one of them is actually shown in the background of this picture, and it's this module you see here called Space Hab. Space Hab just stands for Space Habitation. And what this is a pressurized module that goes into the cargo bay of the orbiter and is connected through to the flight deck, mid-deck area, the crew area of the orbiter, with a tunnel and an airlock, so that we can open that up in flight and go back in there and work and conduct experiments in there, basically in a shirt-sleeve environment. And we carried a number of experiments in this module looking at the effect of weightlessness, or more strictly, microgravity on various living, biological, and physical systems. And that was one of the primary aims of this flight, was to look at how microgravity affects certain living species and to look at how microgravity affects physical processes, in particular in our efforts to grow crystals of semiconductor materials, since there is some evidence that you can grow superior semiconductor types of materials, crystals of semiconductor materials, in space. So we had a very busy workload just running this one facility that you see here. Other payloads that we carried, I don't want to give you the impression that an astronaut's life is all flying. It's not. As you can see, we spent a lot of time studying these payloads and a lot of classroom time learning how they worked, learning about the science, and learning how to fix the payload in the event that something were to fail on orbit, because when we're flying, we are the operators and the repairmen. If anything goes wrong, it's our responsibility to fix it. So we really need to have a pretty good grasp of how these payloads work, and this is just one of the many, many training sessions we had in the operation of the payloads for this flight. Another experiment that we had is shown here. This is the second major experiment, and this is a satellite that we deployed on the second day of the mission, what we call flight day two. And you'll hear me refer to this as a Spartan, because that's the name of this satellite in the lower half of this structure you see here. It's just the NASA name for it, a Spartan. This is a free-flying satellite that you can pick up out of the payload bay with the remote manipulator arm and release it. And it's flown many times. But what was unique for our flight was that we had this canister on top of it here, which carried what we called the inflatable antenna experiment. And what this is an effort to prove that you can make large space-borne structures by unfurling and inflating them like balloon-like on orbit. And the model system that we had here was a large radar-type dish, a parabolic-type radar dish with three tripod legs. And it's folded up inside that canister, and on automated commands, it is commanded to open and then to begin an inflation sequence. And you'll see more of what I mean about that when I show the video and you actually see it inflate. It turned out to be a very spectacular and successful experiment. The third satellite that we deployed is shown here, this small one here. You see, it's quite small. We actually left it up there. In fact, it's still in orbit. It's going to come down sometime next year, I believe. And this is just with some of the training teams and the technicians who assembled it for us. And what this one is a passive satellite that's designed to see if you can use the forces, the very weak forces that exist in low Earth orbit, to stabilize the attitude of a satellite. And let me elaborate a little on that so you understand what we're trying to do here. Imagine that you have a satellite orbiting the Earth. You would like that satellite to always point at perhaps one position on the Earth. For example, it might be a camera taking photographs of the surface of the Earth. Well, clearly, as it goes round, it's got to maintain an attitude where it's always looking down at the below it on the surface of the Earth. Now, you can do that with complicated attitude control systems and sophisticated avionics and propellant, which you fire jets to keep it pointed where you want. And many satellites do that. However, that's a very complicated system that you have, and also it requires a tank full of propellant, which eventually will be depleted, and then your satellite can become inactive. What we're doing with this is using the forces that exist in low Earth orbit to achieve the same goal, the same stable attitude on orbit. And there's two forces that we use. One is the fact that even though we're in space, there is very tenuous atomic gas up there, atomic oxygen. It's very, very, very thin because it's basically a vacuum, but there are some atomic forces there which you can actually use to stabilize a satellite. The other force that we're using is the Earth's magnetic field, and this satellite actually contained rods in it such that when they swept through the Earth's magnetic field, they would generate a force, and that force would damp out any oscillations to the satellite's motion. Now, these forces are very weak, of course, and so we had to deploy the satellite and track it for several days to see what kind of stable orbit it adopted in flight. And that required some very careful flying of the orbiter, because we had to bring the orbiter up behind it and maintain a very careful relative position to the satellite. And that's not an easy task to do, because you're subject to a lot of effects of Earth's gravitational field and so on. So one of the great things of our flight was that we performed these really tricky flying motions in space. Now, while we were going through all of this payload training, our vehicle was being prepared for flight at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Most of our training we did at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. But in Florida, at the launch site, the vehicle was actually assembled for flight. And it begins by bringing in the components of the solid rocket boosters that I talked about, you see here, and starting to stack them on the launch platform inside an assembly building prior to launch. This takes place a couple of months before launch. And this is one of the aft segments of the solid rocket boosters. And there's a number of these segments which are stacked together to make each solid rocket booster. And here you can see the nozzle of the solid rocket booster as it's being lifted up. And here's another view of the other end of the solid rocket booster. You remember I mentioned that these boosters are actually separated from the vehicle. They follow a ballistic trajectory for a while, and once they've slowed down, parachutes are deployed, and they're brought down into the ocean, and we have recovery ships out there at each launch, which tow them back to Cape Canaveral, and they're stripped down, refurbished, and prepared for another flight. This shows the forward nose cone on one of the boosters, and here you can see the parachute assembly, which will actually pop out under a altitude sensor command and bring the boosters down into the ocean. The other component that I talked about is the external tank, which you can see here. And you can see some sense of how big this tank is. This is actually built in Louisiana and shipped by barge around the coast to the east coast of Florida. This is it turned vertical and being mated to the solid rocket boosters. You can't see the solid rocket boosters, they're off to the sides, but you can see these large structural elements here and here. These are the points where the orbiter will actually be physically attached. So these points here are what take the thrust of the launch and carry the orbiter up and take the thrust of the orbiter's engines during ascent. So they're fairly substantial pieces of structure. And you can get an idea of the scale of it by looking at my crewmate standing there. You can see that this is engineering on a pretty impressive scale. Down here, with metal covers over them, are the feed lines where the fuel is actually fed into the orbiter. So the base of the orbiter will mate on here, and the fuel from these tanks will flow into the base of the orbiter and into the engines through these lines here. These are big lines. These are 17-inch diameter lines, and each engine consumes the fuel at a rate of 1,000 pounds a second. So there's a very fast flow of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen coming out of these lines into the orbiter to feed the engines. The engines themselves go through an extensive refurbishment after each flight, as you can see here. These are really amazing pieces of technology. They take liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen and they burn it, and from the combustion they drive high-speed turbo pumps, and there's a high-speed oxygen pump and a high-speed fuel pump on each side of the engine. This is one of the pumps here, another one is over here, and these pumps in turn pump the fuel into the main combustion chamber inside here, where it's burned and develops the thrust. As I said, the thrust is about 430,000 pounds for each engine. So they go. These engines, because of the way they perform, go through a very careful engineering analysis after each flight to make sure that they have good integrity, because when you're dealing with cryogenic fuels flowing at these rates and forces of these kinds of magnitudes, there's very little margin for error. We have three engines in the base of the orbiter. This is the base of the orbiter itself here. You can see some of the protection tiles on it and the body flap and the trailing body flap of the orbiter. And the engines will be mounted in here, three of them there, as a cluster. And these are used, as I said, for the second stage ascent. The orbiter itself goes through very extensive refurbishment as well. One of the elements that gets a lot of attention is the thermal protection system, or more simply, the tiles. There's 30,000 of these tiles surrounding the orbiter, and they provide protection to the orbiter during re-entry. We re-enter the atmosphere so fast that there's a lot of compressive heating of the air as it flows around the orbiter. In fact, the orbiter will glow red hot. The entire vehicle, external surface of the vehicle, becomes red hot during entry, incandescent. And these tiles absorb that heat and re-radiate it to space without it soaking down into the structure of the orbiter. So they provide essential protection for us during entry. It's inevitable that some of them are damaged, and after each flight, they go over and they replace broken tiles. Each tile is individually catalogued and machined and installed by hand on the base of the orbiter, as you can see here. It's a very labour-intensive operation, but it's clearly a very important operation. Once the orbiter has been fully refurbished, the hydraulic units have been refurbished, the auxiliary power units have been refurbished, the electrical power system's been refurbished, the crew compartment's been refurbished, life support systems have been refurbished, the engines have been installed and refurbished, and all the reaction control systems and orbital maneuvering systems have been refurbished. As you can see, a very big undertaking. Then the orbiter itself is taken over to the assembly building, usually late at night when no one's around, and it's lifted up and turned vertical and carried up into the rafters of this huge building in order to be mated with the other elements that make up the complete stack. And this gives you some idea of the scale of that operation. This shows an orbiter, it's actually not the one I flew, this is Discovery, but being mated to an external tank. Now down here you can see these truss elements which I showed you earlier with my crewmate standing next to them. So you can see what kind of scale we have here. We have about 160 feet for the external tank here, 150 feet for each one of these solid rocket boosters. The orbiter itself is about 100 feet long. So this is engineering on a very big scale, and it's an amazing operation to see them lower this huge orbiter by the crane down onto these attach points with precision of the orders of millimeters so that they can attach it to this complete stack. It's amazing engineering. Once the orbiter is fully mated to the stack, the entire assembly is taken from the assembly building down this crawlerway on a crawler and up and placed over the flame trench at the launch pad here. There, ground umbilicals are hooked into it so that all the launch sequence commands can be sent to it. It is loaded with cryogenic hydrogen and oxygen, which runs the fuel cells, which provides electricity. The orbital maneuvering engines and the reaction control engines are all loaded with hydrazine, monomethyl hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide. Life support systems are charged. It's charged with oxygen. Crew compartment is prepared, and the whole vehicle is ready for flight. The external tank is not fueled yet. That will be done in the hours immediately preceding launch, because you can't maintain cryogenic hydrogen and oxygen, liquid hydrogen, for long periods of time in this tank. So that's the last thing that's done prior to crew going in. About 2 weeks before flight, we go down to the Cape, and we go through a complete dry run of the countdown. We strap inside the orbiter, go through a countdown with a simulated pad abort, and learn about all the procedures and all the things that we're going to see and feel during the full countdown. If that's successful, we come back a couple of weeks later for the full blown countdown and flight into space.